So, welcome everybody to Big Cat Diary Uncut, our second series of podcasts, and this is episode 7 of 10. It's the year 2005, and it's called Honey and Toto. Now, every season, this is the third season of Big Cat Week, and we're always keen to try and move the brand forward, to try and give a different feeling to it. So as we keep our audience, you know, feeling that we're not just sitting back and smelling the roses, so to speak. And in this program, we were able to benefit from some wonderful aerial shots of the Mara, because we had were helping to accommodate the Planet Earth crew, and in exchange for some aerials. And the aerials were photographed by helicopters. Seems such a totally different world when I think about it. So this is 2005. Now we're 2003, so 18 years later, and it's all about drones. And of course, it's always been about noise and disturbance, and helicopters are very noisy, and drones are becoming quieter and quieter and can give you the most extraordinary aerial views and perspectives. But back then, it was helicopters, and we certainly benefited from being able to share with you one of the reasons why it's so wonderful to photograph big cats in the Masai Mara, because of the incredible visibility. The terrain is so open. You can stand above the spring, which feeds Musiara Marsh, dry season heart of Marsh Pride territory, and you can stand on a low ridge and look all the way, 5 kilometers away, at a guess, to Rhino Ridge. You can look pretty much over the full extent, maybe 50 square kilometers, of Marsh Pride territory. So the visibility is extraordinary. And one of the ways that we economize on our time with our spotters, with our guides, with our camera crews, with our presenters, is for us to fan out, pick a high point, sit, stand up out of your roof hatch, with your binoculars, in our case, our beautiful Swarovskis. We prefer 10-time magnification for big cat watching. For birds, 8 times. Wider field of view, better light gathering. But with those binoculars, you can look seemingly to every far horizon. And you can look for the impala, all looking in one direction, all the topi, all the wildebeest, looking, staring, pointing you towards where perhaps the predator that you're looking for might well be. They may be staring into a bush. Maybe it's a leopard, just tucked away. They can't see it. Perhaps they can smell it. Perhaps they can see it. And then it stopped. And now they daren't move. And we have what's called flight distance, the distance at which a prey animal feels it can be close enough to a predator, but able to turn and run and get away. So the distance that it feels safe standing and looking. And sometimes, as I say, they can't see, but they can smell. Or out of the corner of their eye, or out of the corner of eye of another herd member, somebody has started to snort in alarm. And everybody's looking. And we're listening too, because as my old friend Joseph Rotich, Buana Chui, said to me, it's not just the power of your vision. It's thinking like you're the cat you're looking for. It's listening. Listening for the alarm call. So if you see impalas staring into a bush and, oh, please God, a jackal starts barking, then it might just be Bella, who, of course, Saba and the leopard crew will be looking for every single day. And in this instance, when they find her, guess what? Chewy, that beautiful male cub, one of the stars of Big Cat Week, the first Big Cat Week 2003, Bella with 2 3-month-old cubs, one of them a female who died, disappeared, probably killed by lions, and the other a male, Chewy. He's now 2 years, 3 months old, and he's still with his mum. Now, why might that be? Probably because she's not pregnant with her next litter of cubs yet. Or she might be, But she's not yet got to the point that she's looking for a den, and she's going to be coming very aggressive to a cub who, or a subadult who is still hanging around her and wanting to tell him in this instance, time to move on. And he'll have been exploring and hunting, as we know, for himself, but still hanging out for part of the time in Bella's territory. Now that could bring hostility from his father or from another male who might move through, a big adult male, and even perhaps a new male who has taken over the territory, if that had happened. And he certainly wouldn't take kindly to Chewy, who by now was beginning to spray mark and was calling like leopards do. That long, well, say long distance, up to 3 kilometres, they say, or up to a kilometre, that can be heard by another leopard. And just a wonderful sound for the human observer. So the actual real star for this particular series, year 2005, would be a little cheetah cub, barely 3 months old, well, certainly 3 months old by the time we finished filming, but I sort of almost describe him as you could have cupped him in the palm of your hand. He was so tiny. The only surviving, a little male cub, I called him Toto, child or young one, in Swahili, a single little cub who had probably survived from his mum's litter, hidden away in a den site, in a thicket, in a marsh, deep in bushes, tucked away. There could have been 6 cubs. There was one cheetah in Nairobi National Park who, I told you, gave birth to 10 cubs, and it was just too much for her. At 3 months of age, she abandoned them, and they had to, or the parks authorities found homes for them. So this little cub, so Toto and his mum, well, at the time, we didn't know that his mum was Honey. Angie guessed it was, but by then we'd just Toto and his mum. And in some ways, because, you know, it was perfect for our audience, because it was just one cub, not 5 little fluffy balls of fur, but a single one. And so his focus, his whole world was his mum, Honey. She was his playmate. There were no other cubs to play with. They had probably been killed by lions or hyenas, which is about 70% of how cheetah cubs die, due to predation, or in the case of predation, if it's a hyena, but lion just killing it because it's a competitor. So huge mortality. But a perfect story for Big Cat Diary. What about Simon? Well, he was happy to be reunited with his old friends, the Marsh Pride. We'd been keeping track of them while Big Cat team was back in Bristol in England. And since last year, 2 new males had taken over the Pride. But a few months ago, one of them was attacked and killed by 3 powerful males from Paradise Plain. Now, we knew these 3 males who roamed to the south of the Marsh Pride, beyond Rhino Ridge. But as males tend to do, and this was 3, so a powerful coalition, they roam widely. They're not content with just breeding with the Paradise females. They would, if they could, breed with the Topi Plains Pride females and the Marsh Pride females, if they could. And they came exploring over Rhino Ridge in early 2005, because 2 new males came to the Marsh Pride, took over end of 2004, Notch and his companion. And some people say the reason those 3 Paradise males came over looking for trouble, looking to actually take on, because they would have heard, they would know who their neighbours were by voice, and sometimes have seen them, and sometimes perhaps 3 against 2 chase them. Well, in this instance, when they were patrolling at the edge of their territory and perhaps heard those 2 Marsh Pride males calling, Notch and his companion, calling to other members of their pride, calling to establish their pride territory, patrolling the boundary, well, we were told that possibly a research unit were playing audible sounds of either hyenas or of other lions so as they could count the lions in the area, so as they could bring the lions out of the woodwork and count how many there were in the area by making a recording to attract them into the open. And that possibly attracted those three paradise males who came over the horizon, came down and attacked Notch and his companion and killed Notch's companion. So now we've got the marshlands with a single pride male Notch. Four lionesses, so that is White Eye, that's Bibi, Carly's daughter, that's Lispy, and Red. Now, I don't want to confuse you, because Saba called one of the lionesses, one of the survivors of the 1998 lion buffalo attack down at Bilashaka, called one of the lionesses Mama Lugger, Mrs. Lugger, in other words, the female who hangs out on Bilashaka, which of course she did, as it is the natal breeding ground for the marsh pride. And we know that Mama Lugger came back to where she'd left her four cubs in 2004 on the Bilashaka Lugger, and they had been found by White Eye and her three cubs, and they joined her, and she'd moved off and they'd followed. And then she joined up with Carly, Bibi's mum, who had three cubs, and suddenly there was a creche of two females, 10 cubs. And Mama Lugger found that she was suddenly without cubs, and not long after started to mate with Blondie, the father of her cubs, as if they'd been killed, as if infanticide had taken place, as if she'd lost her cubs. Fortunately for the pride system and the creche system, the cubs survived. Now Notch is in his prime, his nose still predominantly pink. So when he took over, end of 2004, he was probably about 4 years of age. So recently, at the end of being a nomad and having established himself probably as a pride male for the first time. And that pink nose, which starts to turn increasingly black with black spots, which gradually coalesce and blacken the whole nose. By the time you're 6 years old, your nose is more than half black. But a single pride male is always vulnerable to a takeover bid. And just before we start filming, our spotters locate two young males trespassing in and around the marsh pride territory. So, you know, young nomadic males or older males who have joined up, who have been pushed out of a pride and now trying to take over another pride or extend their breeding opportunities a little while longer, there's always somebody looking to push their luck. There's always somebody listening and watching and taking note of any sense of weakness in terms of the territorial system and setup. So in the Mara, as a whole, 1,500 square kilometres, and so that's about 600 square miles, there's about 22 pride territories, groups of lions. And so it is prime real estate. And around the edges is where you have private land, owned by the Maasai, now subdivided into individual plots, but previously owned as group ranches, so a communal form of land use, where the wild animals still, as they do now, even though subdivision has taken place, not everybody is fenced, and some of those areas collectively, the holders of the title of the land have come together to form wildlife conservancies. And the animals move freely through there, there's cattle there, but where a wildlife conservancy has been established, there is an agreement amongst the landowners that they will make a deal with tour operators, leasing them land to build camps on a sustainable basis. So one bed night per 700 acres, less vehicles, a more eco-friendly form of tourism than perhaps in the reserve, which is getting very crowded with lots of facilities, lots of vehicles. So the wildlife conservancies are a great option if you want to have less cars and a more relaxed game drive and perhaps better game viewing, less of a circus. And so around those areas, you've got lions who are not able to establish themselves in prides within the reserve, and they get pushed to the edges. And when those young males, particularly, and young females are forced out of their prides and are nomadic, their easy option, of course, at times, is to take livestock, and they'll pay the price when they do. Now, Notch is going to have a battle on his hands to maintain his tenure. And interestingly, when I think about the history of our watching the Marsh Pride and of watching the transitions for the male coalitions over time, the average in the Marsh Pride would be two males, occasionally three, but often two. And invariably, at some point, one of the coalition would be killed by a buffalo, like happened to Blondie, leaving Simba on his own, killed by the Maasai in a conflict situation, like happened to Scruffy, leaving Scar on his own, and then now conflict with other lands, leaving Notch on his own. So trouble with pastoralists, trouble with other lions, and basically just trying to find yourself a territory and hang on to it for as long as you can. So for the males, it can be a very short tenure. In times, sometimes just no more than 2 years. It could be 6 months. But certainly Scar got a couple of years. Simba, 3 to 4 years. Well, Notch is going to be another story. But at this point, he was looking very, very vulnerable. And the two nomads who were hanging around at one point really tried to push him, like we saw happen to Simba. And Simon wasn't sure, will I find Notch again? Because he was roaring and he was, you know, putting on a big display. So he's going to have a battle on his hands, mirroring events we witnessed with Simba 2 series ago. The question that we all hope will provide a storyline for Simon is, will Notch be able to hold his own, or will he be forced to capitulate to the young nomads and abandon his pride to the fate? Now, strangely, the three paradise males who came over the rise and clobbered Notch's companion, they then didn't stay and establish themselves at that point with the Marsh Pride. They went back to the Paradise Pride. It was as if, okay, done the business, shown who's the boss. Maybe there's going to be business here later, but not right now. And there would be business later, but not right now. Well, star of the series was going to unquestionably be Little Toto. Because, you know, what a great story. And if I think about over the years with Big Cat Diary, Big Cat Week, and eventually Big Cat Live, yes, we had the little lion cub Solo. An extraordinary story for our audience, and great action, great jeopardy, everybody on the edge of their seat, everybody totally involved emotionally with rooting for this little guy, of course, who did survive and went on to become a pride male. And then, of course, Zawadi, going back in time, the female cub born to Halftail, our legendary leopard, the leopards of 1996. And what an incredible animal Zawadi would be, because even though she faded to some degree from the Big Cat Diary storyline, for us, we followed her story into her 17th year. She died around 2012, so quite a while after Big Cat Live 2008, we continued to follow her story. What an extraordinary thing to be able to follow a big cat from when she's a little cub all the way through her life, and she was still breeding at that time. But as I say, that's another story. So Toto goes everywhere with his mother, as we've said, turns out to be Honey. And, you know, this was going to throw up some scenes in which we knew the audience would be asking that age-old story, but surely you're not going to let this little cub die. It's almost as if the audience literally did want me to pick him up and pop him in the back of the car and drive around, you know, accompany Honey on her journey, ensure, you know, pop him out from time to time, let him go back to mum, have a cuddle, you know, just get a little bit of food and then come back in the car when trouble hit. Well, trouble would hit, because on one occasion, we are going to where we had left. Angie's spotting for us with Chris Bennon. We've got Warren Samuels and his team. You know, everybody's flat out with this story. And on one particular occasion, Angie or Chris Bennon radio in and say, you're not going to believe it, but the three paradise males are moving towards what we had called Toto's Hill. So you go from Governor's Camp over Rhino Ridge, 5 kilometres, 8 kilometres, down onto Paradise, little rocky hill there with some thickets, some croton bushes. And we knew that at times Honey would take Toto up onto that rocky outcrop, just sort of hang out at the base of those bushes, keep a low profile, try and stay hidden during the night, not run into trouble. Well, one morning we bump into the paradise males. They are looking like pride males do, on patrol, huge. These three big males, 400 pound apiece, 180 kilos each, and looking really menacing. Great filming, great action, great jeopardy. They're heading toward Honey's or Toto's Hill. And we see them approach, and we haven't found Honey and Toto at this point. We're just hoping and presuming, or were, that they were up on that hill. And now, suddenly, the Lans are walking up the rock face, and one of them's looking extremely interested. We are holding hearts, our hearts are in our mouth, and then Chris, I think, says, "It's okay. It's a lioness." "Yes, but where's Honey? Where is Toto?" Because for a mother cheetah, whether she's got one cub or a whole group of them, it is like walking through a minefield, because these little cubs are so visible. Their only hope is their speed of reaction, is for mum to be able to somehow hold the fort while the little cub gets away. But if it's chased by a lion, well, it's just not going to make it, not at that age. That's why so many of these little cubs disappear. And at the very beginning, when I meet Toto, I'm thinking to myself and sharing with the audience the fact that, you know, if this little cub survives through to the end of the series, it will be a miracle. Well, up to this point, the miracle was happening. And then on one occasion, we're down near paradise, and inevitably we are there when real trouble kicks in, because two baboons out walking across the savannas, good colour vision, pin sharp eyes, very alert, and who will chase a cheetah off a kill? Those big males, they're not frightened, not of a cheetah. They'll just run in there, showing those big thumb-sized canine teeth, and the cheetah will have to flee and release, maybe it's killed an impala or whatever it is. And I've seen a male baboon just chase three cheetahs away and take over the impala kill they've just made and just sit there just like the one did with my bag of crisps and just snack on it. You know, it's thank you very nice, thank you very much, I'll have that. And the cheetah obviously can't afford to be injured. She can hunt again. Why try and go face to face with a baboon that can seriously, could kill her cubs? So we're down on Paradise Plain, two male baboons, and they spot Honey and Toto. And we had been talking about this kind of scenario, and I'm just going to actually look for the place in Stars of Big Cat Diary, the book, where I describe when this happens. Because we'd actually been thinking, as just like you would, you know, what are you going to do? Are you just going to seriously, if lions attack this little cub, or if something's going to happen, are you going to let that just carry on? So all of us knew that at some point during our month-long shoot, we would be faced with a dilemma. What do you do when an animal such as Toto is under threat? Do you intervene on the cub's behalf? That moment arrived when two male baboons appeared on the scene, attracted to Honey's kill by the vultures hovering overhead. You see, cheetahs killing in the daytime, avoiding lions and hyenas, dragging a kill as quickly as they can into cover, hoping that they can do that before the first vulture plummets from the sky, because you better believe, even though you're hunting in the daytime because probably the lions and hyenas are hanging out, snoozing hopefully in the shade, they will keep one eye open. And if they see a funnel of vultures just dropping from the sky, they will be up, opportunistic, somebody's killed. Is it an enemy? Is it a pride male, pride lion, or part of the pride if you're a lioness? Is it a competitor? Is it just a free meal? Because if it is, we want it, either by force of numbers or because we're bigger than you. And cheetah is at the very bottom of the big cat pyramid. And including that, the hyenas too, you know, a cheetah's got to give way to virtually everything. Even vultures at times can force, a great mob of 200 vultures can force a cheetah from a kill eventually. Eaten enough, no point in just putting up with this noise and squabbling of rushing in, the jackals are coming, let's get out of here. And so that a moment arrived when two male baboons appeared on the scene, attracted to Honey's kill by the vultures hovering overhead. By chance, my DV director, Toby Strong, asked me the day before what I would do if such an occasion arose. By this time, all of us had become enchanted by the cheetah cub, so Toby couldn't quite believe it when I said, without hesitation, that I would let nature take its course. I mean, Toby is the most lovely guy. He's the most incredible cameraman. He's just been filming on the Nat Geo elephant movie and on, you know, the joys of social media, the best side of it. I was able to connect with Toby after all these years since Big Cat Diary, when he was such a star cameraman and DV cameraman, often, you know, tasked with making me look good on telly if he could, or catching my reactions. And he was visibly upset and insisted that we ask Warren Samuels, who's our wildlife cameraman, cheetah specialist, what he'd do. Warren's answer was the same as mine. He'd film whatever took place. That was his job as a wildlife cameraman. Now, in the program, we see Honey respond immediately to the danger posed by the baboons, walking towards them with her head lowered in threat. So a cheetah mum's best chance is put your hackles up, make yourself look twice as large, growl, look threatening, and rely on your speed. And so she's trying to lead the baboons away from the cubs, but baboons are not, you know, they're seeing that cub and they're probably thinking, you know what, we don't like what we see, we could kill this, not to eat it, but now they want to just, it's a predator, they want to mob it, they want to hurt it if they can, they want to teach it a lesson or try and force the mother and the cubs to move away. If there's food, better still, we'll take it. Toto flees for his life, then stops and calls with that high pitch. Calls for his mother, a potentially suicidal instinct on his part. You know, but then remember, his life revolves around mum. There's no other cubs. He's got no brothers or sisters. It's just him and her. He doesn't like to be separated. And at this point, he's big enough to want to follow her wherever she goes. He's not content with being left at a den while she goes off to hunt. If she goes off to hunt, he's going to follow. When she roars off to try and kill something, he may sit still for a moment till she calls him. I turn to camera, conscious of my conversation with Toby. You cannot intervene. It's just not fair. But your heart is crying out. I believe that. But I'd gone to bed the previous evening thinking about what Toby had said, questioning whether or not I had to act as I'd said I would. Is there another option? I'm human, after all. Surely it's only natural to want to try to save the life of another creature. But we can't play God. Nature has its own rules, and we have to respect them. And the bottom line is, the park rules or the reserve rules, the authorities state that you are not to intervene. You're there purely, I don't want to say spectator, because it's not meant to be entertainment. It's meant to be a privilege. It's meant to be something of wonder to sit and watch nature unfold in this kind of way and have these extraordinary animals tolerate us, albeit in our vehicles. But we don't want to try and tip the sway, the balance of nature in the way that we humans think's right. Because if we did, no vultures, no hyenas, no wild dogs, no crocodiles, no snakes, no vulture, you know, how would the landscape look? There's a perfect symmetry to it just as it is. Anyway, one thing is for certain. There is no need to look for a dramatic ending to this program. We have a real-life cliffhanger for our audience. In the end, Honey's tactics of first letting the baboons know she's there, then trying to distract them and keeping her cool head pay off. Toto crouches in the grass as one of the baboons moves closer. It sits, plucking at the fresh green leaves that have sprung up in the wake of the rains. You could just tell it knows what's going on. It's not fooled by this, but it's probably thinking it to itself. I'm not sure if this is worth getting slapped by Honey with those fast-moving paws. Slap, bang, bang. Because even though the claws, we might describe them as blunt, as cleats for running, except for that one on the wrist, the dew claw, which is sharp as a razor. But What's in it? You know, you've got to understand that everything that goes on out there, it's not just showtime. The baboon's going to, you know, might want drama and action, but the baboon's going to do exactly what it decides it does according to how hungry it is, how much in danger it would be in if it was proactive, and is it worth getting involved, or should we just carry on? After all, we're primarily grass eaters. We're omnivores. Yes, we take insects, reptiles, birds' eggs, and occasionally we will take a young gazelle or a young impala. And we will sometimes kill a cheetah cub. But in this instance, after what seems like an eternity, it gets up and moves away. Once it is safe to approach, Honey walks carefully towards the patch of grass where Toto lies hidden. I tell you, it feels like just yesterday, sitting and watching this in my vehicle. She bends down and acknowledges the cub's existence with the most cursory of licks. It's an incredibly powerful piece of television, full of all of the emotions that one faces in these heart-rending moments. By the end of the series, Toto's name is on everyone's lips. So we knew that we were onto a winner, and I think that to this day, the story of Toto encapsulates everything that Big Cat Diary came to mean to our audiences. An emotional, intense, wonderful experience. If you can't come to Africa and enjoy a safari for yourself, and if you do, you've got to come to the Mara, the Masai Mara, or the Serengeti, or both. There is nowhere like it on Earth. We describe it as the last place on Earth. But you have to come and see it for yourself, because if you think it looks good on television, then I can promise you the real thing is even better. Now, one of the elements of Big Cat that people love is following individual cats from one series to the next. So we're delighted when Angie spotted Kike, accommodated by a male. This most certainly meant that she was an estrus and ready to mate, something that you rarely witness with cheetahs. Kike made a beeline for Warren's camera car, leaping up onto the canvas awning that Warren had a sidecar like I did. So he had an extension. He took the door off his regular car door, had an extension like a little gun carriage that he could turn his legs out into and spin. He had a camera mount on the side rail, and he could then get a 180-degree swing of his camera. And then he had a sunshade, a canvas awning over the top of them. Well, Kike thought, yes, just like a hammock. Let's just jump up there and lie in it. So makes a beeline for Warren's camera car, leaping up onto the canvas awning that acted as a sunshade over his camera door. We chuckled as Warren desperately tried to keep the awning from collapsing like a soggy umbrella onto his arms. After a while, she took the hint and settled down on the roof, much to the chagrin of the male cheetah, who stood with his front paws up against the spare wheel, perplexed and frustrated. He obviously wasn't one of those cheetahs who had learned to climb onto vehicles as a cub, and he wasn't about to start now. Eventually, Kike jumped down and rolled onto the ground in front of the young male, who looked inexperienced around an estrus female. We waited all day for the courting couple to mate until, desperate for a pee, Warren and I moved away for a moment, leaving Angie to keep watch. Just as we were relieving ourselves, Angie called on the radio. We thought she was winding us up, to say the cheetahs were about to mate. We scrambled back into our vehicles, but it was too late. Copulation in cats is brief at the best of times and very repetitive, we hoped. Anyway, we missed the shot. We hadn't told the producers that, of course, what we were up to. Next time we needed to pee, we would definitely use an empty water bottle. And I can promise you, you do not want to do that, because your mates will definitely film you. Anyway, Kike disappeared sometime in 2006, shortly after losing her latest cubs. She failed to raise another litter after the success of 2003-2004. So those three cubs were the only ones, as far as we know, that she raised to maturity. When we last saw her, it was tragic, pathetic. She looked old and was in poor health. She was later treated for mange, so that's a mite infestation, which often comes when an animal is stressed. So we all scratched our heads and wondered, you know, what was this all about? And we'll talk again about that. But never recovered to full strength. It was a sad end for our star cheetah. Now, Saba, I mean, you know, the leopard drill or the leopard, you know, being given that as your task, that is no easy one. But I was so fortunate in the early days of Big Cat Diary when I was doing the leopard to have Half Tail and Zawadi, because they just made it so easy. They were so habituated to vehicles. We had Leopard Gorge, Fig Tree Ridge. We had this perfect canvas to film these leopards against, and we could find them every day. And it was a different kind of habitat. So the Talek area, it's a beautiful tributary which runs into the Mara River. And it's got these wonderful rocks. It's got like koppies, so rocky outcrops along the edges. You've got these grey slabs of almost like tiling in the base of the river itself. So the water, which is intermittent at times, so it flows year round, but sometimes it's almost just pools. And you've got these beautiful stones like plinths. And occasionally you'll see a big cat, a lion, a leopard walking over these rocks through the waterways. So just a fantastic shot when you can get it. And everybody's always hoping that we'll come across leopards or cheetahs crossing the Talek or moving along the Talek, as they sometimes do. And so it's a beautiful scenario, but there's also plenty of thickets. There's some beautiful trees, but there's a lot of places that a leopard can hide, and it really needs to, because it's a great place for lions too. And it's an ambush site for when the wildebeest are on migration through the Mara, because they come down to the Talek to drink and at times to cross. So scenically, the Talek area where Bella lives really lends itself to photography. It's a beautiful mosaic of grasslands broken by patches of croton bush and bisected by the winding course of the river with its slabs of grey stone and the distinctive silhouettes of giant fig trees. The river is the heart of Bella's territory, somewhere she can hide her cubs and ambush prey, a retreat from the prying eye of visitors when they press too close, and a safe refuge from the pride of lions that also covet this place. You always expect her to emerge suddenly from cover and rejoice when she does. You can almost hear the rush of adrenaline Sabra is experiencing as a herd of wildebeest mass along the riverbank, crammed together so tightly that they can barely move. Startled, they stampede away as Bella rushes in behind them, closing within easy reach of the stragglers. Surely this time she must succeed, but she hesitates. They're all adults, and she's hoping for a calf. When she finally does make a kill that we can film, it's a huge relief for all of us, and there's a good deal of celebrating on the way home to camp that night. So it was a 45-minute drive at dark, in the darkness. You're absolutely beat by the end of the day by, you know, the rigors of filming, by the sun beating down on the car, by having to keep your eyes absolutely peeled so as you don't lose sight of your leopard or your cheetah or your lions, that you're ready for whatever action might happen. But when you get a good sequence and you come back, and maybe you'll see some of the clips that the editors are putting together, because they're actually editing under canvas back at the Big Cat camp along the banks of the Mara River. So we would at times have viewings, we'd come and look at how the storylines were progressing. And of course, in this particular series, that little cheetah cub, Toto, just kept delivering time after time after time. So just in terms of thinking about what was going on with our three stories, so we knew we actually had it made with Toto. With the lion story, it was okay. We had Notch, and he was doing everything he could to try and keep close to the females, to White Eye, Red, BB, and Lispy, and also the 8 half-grown cubs. So they're all about just under a year of age. So there's 8 cubs who were sired by Notch and by his companion before the companion was killed by the paradise males. And so you've got a good group of lions. But one of the stories that Simon was concentrating on was that there was a female who would become very prominent in the following year's filming, 2006, who we called Tamu. And Tamu was a young lioness, and we were struggling to figure out who she was, because it was quite evident she was a marsh lion. She was born to the marsh pride. And yet we couldn't quite figure who is this one? Because she was moving around. She was of a different generation to White Eye, Mama Lugger or Red, Lispy and BB. But was she perhaps one of those two females, youngsters, that hung around with Nusu Nusu? Now, Nusu Nusu had disappeared, as had Kali, Bibi's mother, probably killed in interactions with the Maasai, because during the rainy season, which occurred when we weren't filming, often the Marsh Bride would move north and start to get into private land where there are cattle, where there are herdsmen, and where the temptation in the rainy season, when it's tough, when there's no wildebeest around from the Serengeti, when you're struggling to find sufficient food, livestock for the Marsh Bride were part of their annual diet. No question about it. They were a boundary pride. Their territory, part in the reserve, part out. And in the rainy season, when times were tough, they'd go north and they would go east. And that led them into and onto private land and into conflict situations. And every year, we would lose some of our lands. And to be honest, we took it for granted. If they transgressed, you couldn't blame the Maasai. The Maasai were trying to, as somebody said, it's like somebody hacked into your bank account. Kill a cow, that's big money. That's big news. That is part of the cultural identity of the Maasai, not just a cow, but something sacred. And so the animal that kills a cow is definitely the enemy. And so that was just part of the equation. But the marshlands over the years, you know, still managed to keep their numbers up and to prosper to a degree. So we knew that for this particular story that we were concentrating on, that it was really, in a sense, was Notch going to be able to keep those two nomadic males away? And he did. And within the marshland story, there was one, wasn't quite a Toto. Well, it was a Toto, but it wasn't Honey's Toto. But there was a tiny little cub, a tiny little land cub, a little female. And she, again, you know, everybody fell in love with her. Everybody wanted to know what she was doing. And you got some beautiful pictures of cubs of different ages, three of them, and with the tiny little one, you know, right at the front being chased by the other cubs. So there was all the various elements that we knew worked with all of our big cats, in as much as there were cubs, okay? A very big cub in terms of Chewy, but with the Marsh Bride cubs, and a story. Now, Notch came across this, as I said, this young female, Tamu, and she was very flirtatious, so she hadn't yet had her first litter of cubs, but she was ready to breed. And she was very flirtatious, and there was some lovely footage that Simon and John Aitchison filmed of her flirting with Notch, and trying, it was the beginning of her estrus, and she was winding herself around him and, you know, then whipping out from underneath him before he could actually mate with her. So she wasn't quite ready at that particular time. But what was happening was that the core group of females, the four adult females, they were extremely aggressive towards her, even though she was part of the pride. And we wondered, could she have been that female cub born to Bibi when she was being ostracized by the pride? Could it have been of one of the two females that hung out, as I say, with Nusu Nusu, who had now grown up? What had happened to them? Could this be Tamu? Well, we have yet to absolutely be certain, but we're pretty sure it was probably one of those two females that used to be with Nusu Nusu, who, as I said, at this point, had disappeared, probably killed by the Maasai, maybe buffalo, who knows at this point. We hadn't witnessed it. So Simon, obviously following the lions, hoping for, you know, some action, some predation. And, you know, all I'm thinking about is about Toto. And as Honey moved around with Toto, there was just, you know, rainstorms and, you know, beautiful shots of this tiny little cub, absolutely sodden wet, you know, trying to hunker down between mum's forelegs and keep from getting wet. And at some point, the inevitable happens. So he disappears. Honey, one day, after that interaction with those male lions and then the baboon, inevitably you knew she was going to have to move. She's got to keep moving. you know, she ranges widely just to try and actually get sufficient food. And one day she disappears and it's like, oh no, I don't believe it. Now what? So the whole of the big cat team now go looking for Toto. We alert all of the guides and the drivers from the other camps. And of course, they also had invested in Toto's story because everybody, every visitor loves to see a tiny little cheetah cub like this and had become engaged in her story. And so, you know, we're looking and looking and looking and there's no sign. And so we're desperate. And I drive down to a crossing point on the Talloc River, still searching for Toto. The river has receded sufficiently for me to cross. And if I can do it, so can the cheetahs. We speak to the drivers from all the other camps, but although everyone is looking, no one has seen them. There are the inevitable false alarms and disappointments. We find a mother with a single cub. I remember this so well, with this little cub, the same age as Toto, but she has an ear tag. Oh, the disappointment. It's wonderful to see this other little cub. And then we find that mum's got an ear tag. Definitely not honey. So by now, we've run out of time. I must draw a line under the events for our audience. 2 days after we left the Mara, we received news from Simon and his wife Marguerite, who'd stayed on to film a sequence on cheetahs for Planet Earth, that honey had been found, but without little Toto. We'll never know what happened, but the odds were always stacked against him. It's harsh out there. These are real-life dramas. Inevitably, for some of our cats, there just can't be a happy ending. And I just want to read you, there was another piece there that I think captured the sense of, you know, everything that all of us tend to feel in these stories. This just gives you an insight of something that happened actually in terms of thinking of Toto's story, about the making of the series and the way, you know, we operated in terms of bringing the stories to life and to you. And a year earlier, so 2004, and just a week before we were due to finish filming, we'd come upon a mother cheetah with a single female cub of around the same age that was that Toto was now. We were all captivated by her and desperate to feature her in the program. But series producer Nigel Pope decided that this would weaken our story with Kike's cubs. Remember, this is 2003 when I'm following Kike's three cubs. And that it was too late for anything but a cameo role for Duma, meaning cheetah in Swahili, as she became known. But once filming finished, Angie and I stayed on for a week or so to follow and photograph Duma. We didn't know her mother well enough to have given her a name at that point, but later, as Shakira, she would become another of our stars. By now, 2005, Duma was almost as large as her mother, and at 14 months old, nearing independence. In fact, later in the series, mother and cub did part company, much for Duma's initial distress. We decided to film Duma as a way of illustrating the fact that despite all the dangers facing young Toto, it was possible for a single cub to survive to independence, that there was hope. And if Toto didn't make it, we would have established another cheetah character that we could follow. Interspersed with the stories of our big cats, there was ample opportunity to celebrate life in the Mara. There's such a variety of habitats and species that we were always spoiled for choice. The wild oscillations in the weather provided plenty of excitement and drama of their own. There were times when it was blistering hot, others when it poured with rain, generating some memorable scenes. The 8 lion cubs gambling about in the deluge, with the older ones unable to resist playing with the little female Modja. And Bella hunting in the rain, creeping towards a herd of gazelles, totally focused on her quarry, still who'd stood hunched with their backs to the wind and rain. The fact was, we had such strong stories with our big cats that we really just didn't have the time. You know, we felt that we wanted to focus on serval cats and caracals and jackals and hyena dens. And we did at time film that kind of footage, but there was just no space at the end. The big cat stories were so powerful. Bella and Chewy, Honey and Toto, Notch, the Marsh Pride, those extraordinary females. There just wasn't time to show everything. And we at times thought about, you know, what about Big Cat Country? Or big cat, little cats. Yes, maybe, but the three big cats, our star big cats, in a place like the Masai Mara, with its extraordinary visibility, just always delivers. Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're enjoying the Big Cat People podcast, it would mean the world to us if you'd give us a follow on Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this episode. And if you'd like to learn more from us, we've recently launched a brand new series of highly requested educational ebooks with a range of topics including wildlife photography, world travel, safari, and more. Our ebooks are available for purchase exclusively from our website at bigcatpeople.com. We appreciate your support and we hope you join us again next week.